Welcome to Ad Exchanger Talks, the podcast devoted to examining the issues and trends in advertising and marketing technology that matter most to you.
Welcome back, everybody. This is Zach Rogers. I'm the executive editor of Ad Exchanger. Great to have you. I'm also pleased to have Keith Grossman in the studio. Welcome, Keith.
Thank you for having me.
Keith, as you probably know, is the global chief revenue officer at Bloomberg Media, which is, you know, I would say a growing media brand in, you know, in the business sector. You guys have something like 2,000 journalists in 130 countries. You're big.
Yeah. 2,700 journalists in 120 countries throughout the world. I think there's 196 countries in the world. So almost everywhere.
Okay. Wow. And you're multi-platform, which, you know, truly multi-platform. So we're talking, you know, digital broadcast, print, radio,
events. Yeah, all five. And it's very interesting.
Absolutely. So we'll talk about all that and try to get a little, I guess, overview of where advertising and programmatic advertising fit into your media sales operation, because because this is a company that doesn't have advertising at its core. So I'm kind of curious how that plays out for what you're trying to do for your team. So maybe we could start there. This is a company that has a made its billions on the terminal business and has more recently expanded into media. And of the media revenue, advertising is part of it. How should we think about Bloomberg and advertising within that larger sort of superstructure of Wall Street tech services?
Sure. So, I mean, in full disclosure, I didn't go to Bloomberg because I thought it was doing something great at the time when I came there. And that's not to discount the work that was happening before in the media space, but I came there because I saw the potential for where it could go and become great. You know, you talk earlier about the size of the editorial footprint. You know, you talk about the multi-platform aspects. I think that there was a huge aspect of the Bloomberg organization in the media front that was not thinking about itself as a media division, but rather as a marketing services arm to the core product. Over the past few years, you know, we've done a lot of things structurally to really evolve it, you know, whether it is really on the most granular level, looking at, you know, how to compensate and think about, you know, the sales force, how the go-to-market strategy is you know, idea-based versus platform-based, what the back-end infrastructure and the operations are. A lot of people focus on, you know, the fact that since Micklethwaite has come on board from The Economist to head up the newsroom, there's been a tremendous amount of editorial hires, or since, you know, Justin brought myself on board and some others, we've had a lot of business side hires. But a lot of people don't focus on the engineering hires that we've done or the PR hires that we've done that have really enabled us to connect the different aspects of our organization together and allow us to start thinking about ourselves not as a marketing services arm, but as a media division. As a media company alone, I mean, we are a tremendous nine-figure, you know, revenue stream on advertising-based revenue by itself.
Okay.
If you were to pull that out of the company, like, it's a gigantic organization. I think that being part of Bloomberg, though, and being part of a private company that is, you know, enables us to be funded by a non-media entity, allows us to think really big and really ambitious on some of the approaches that we might take to navigating where media is going.
Okay, that's great. And so how would you characterize the goal for your team? What is the global chief revenue officer's job? Is it 100% advertising? Is there a mix? Are there other revenue streams that you're trying to drive?
You know, like, at the end of the day, I think about my job in the sense of ensuring that I can motivate the team to think bigger about Bloomberg, that I can empower, you know, the leaders in every region to think more creatively, and that I can remove obstacles to make sure that it can flow more seamlessly, whether it's in sales or marketing, right? And I work very close with the ops team as well, which is really important and instrumental in that. I don't think that my goal is purely to think about the organization from, like, how can we get one more ad dollar? in a marketplace where ads might be increasingly moving towards programmatic, or you know, the traditional means of securing ad dollars is essentially a downward spiral towards zero. Mm-hmm. I think that where I'm challenged and what my role is to always think and push creatively into where can we go and where is the next, not sort of place to be, but like where is the industry navigating towards to ensure that we have pivoted our position to be there for when that change occurs.
Okay.
A good example of it would be, you know, the OTT space. Very little revenue in 2016 in OTT revenue. When I say OTT, over the top, Apple TV, Samsung Smart Hub, Roku.
Would this be via the Bloomberg app that people install on their?
Yeah, like on Apple TV. You know, okay. It's there. And you know, when I think about the future of television, and mm-hmm. I think about, you know, my daughter, and you know, my daughter's three, and she says to me, "Daddy, I want to watch TV," but she does not mean linear television, right? She actually has no relationship to our cable provider itself.
Right.
Like
mm-hmm.
her definition of TV is not digital video either, right? Which is the common misperception. Her relationship to TV is there's a screen, and I want to view it.
Mm-hmm.
And there's video coming over that screen. And I think that when you start thinking about this current generation and even more so the next generation and following for eternity, you hear about cord cutters consistently, but you see a huge disconnect between the way in which media is bought and sold and strategized and the way in which the consumer behavior is moving mm-hmm. at times. And there's no doubt in my mind that these devices, Apple TV, as I mentioned earlier, the Samsungs, the Rokus, the Amazons, the Googles of the world, one day become invisible. They're just embedded into television. And the number of cord cutters in the world is just so large. It's the same sort of phenomenon as people who said, "I don't want a landline anymore."
Right. So this is a company that's going after emerging platforms, making a significant investment even though you don't have any appreciable revenue at the time.
Correct.
For now. You I'm sure you're out there talking about the OTT stuff because, well, that's an exciting future opportunity. It helps the Bloomberg brand mm-hmm. to be there at your new fronts and be able to talk about your OTT apps. I mean, that's pretty cool.
Definitely.
How do you package the Bloomberg audience? What's the way that you think about the valuable audience that you have?
Well, it's an interesting question. And it's actually the question that got me most excited about the organization itself, right? So if you think about the organization in its purest sense and its most misrepresented sense, mm-hmm. It's purely the terminal, which is Wall Street, global financial leaders throughout the world. And if you look at the number of those individuals that we have that pay, you know, for a terminal throughout the world, it's about 326,000
right.
and change.
And what does
right.
one terminal cost for 1 year again?
It can range, but it's, you know, upper $20,000.
Okay.
It's a big business. It's a great business. When you engage with the terminal itself, you realize the value so quickly
right.
and what it has to offer and all the functions and how powerful this device is. When
this
you
was
don't
the original Bloomberg audience was right. the Wall Street trader.
Correct, right? And the notion was bring transparency to, you know, the bond market initially and bring the buy side and the sell side together. And then ultimately more tools were added and this device is just an unbelievably powerful closed network, right?
Mm-hmm.
And very similar to a Facebook or whatnot, but closed and very exclusive. And
a walled garden, if you will.
Well, it is. It's like a walled garden with a bigger wall outside of it, right? And then a bigger wall outside of that. But you know, what's fascinating about the walled garden itself is that ultimately it connected all of these individuals together, and it allowed them to become sort of the glue to a much larger industry. Now, for us, When you look at everyone who engages with the Bloomberg brand, right, it's about 62 million people throughout the world, right? So the question that we were originally faced with was the perception is the 327,000. The reality is 62 million. Who are the 61.7 million people who are not terminal users? Mm-hmm. And from that, we started to realize that we had people in marketing and we had people in banking, not just pure finance. We had people in, you know, the B2B space and the consulting space, and we had people in all of these different areas. And as we started to think about the holistic aspect of the brand, it started to make sense that there were certain verticals that really mattered to us as an organization. And I think that those verticals are really well defined by some of the Twitter handles that we have secured for ourselves. So a lot of people don't realize that if you like business, we are at business. If you like technology, we are at technology. If you like luxury, we're at luxury. Someone might say to us, luxury makes no sense. But the reality is that our audience is a very affluent, very influential, very successful group of people. They
Somebody
care
on
about,
Bloomberg's marketing team was really into Twitter in the early days.
They actually, in the past
Who
year
was
and
that?
A half,
are they still there?
They were excellent at securing the handles. But, you know, we also have at Brexit. We have at economics.
Oh, wow.
We have at climate, which is an important initiative for Mike himself. So these are things that we play with in terms of ensuring that as we disseminate information, and we produce from those journalists about 5,000 pieces of content a day, of mm-hmm. which about 20% of them are made public outside of the terminal, to give you an idea of how much information is within the mm-hmm. walled garden, mm-hmm. You get an idea of, you know, how much content this organization can actually provide its mm-hmm. community.
Okay, great. So you have many, many readers and watchers and listeners from different industries. It's a business audience.
Mm-hmm.
So are you packaging and selling industry verticals to industry advertisers primarily, or are you doing more hyper-segmentation and thinking of it as a consumer, a B2C monetization opportunity?
Sure.
It would seem like the former is a bigger opportunity. But I could be wrong.
It's an interesting question. It's not an either or. We're kind of doing both. If you look at take this table, for instance, that we're sitting in front of, and for the audience, we're sitting in front of a round
table. Please
describe
the table.
Right? It's beautiful, beautiful. If Trump was here, he'd say it's the most magnificent round table we've ever seen.
It's a tremendous
table.
It has some black coasters on it, two glasses. Okay,
they're
the
phenomenal. if you were to divide the table in half, 50% of our revenue is financial advertisers, uh-huh. right, and partners. And when you start thinking about the financial partners that we have, I would say about 25% of those are more consumer-facing, mm-hmm. right, the ones that everyone would hear of. I would say 25% of them are partners that you have to be very, very, very specific within the financial space to be able to play in. You know, these are the ones that are either very specific fixed income or ETF or money managers that, are not going to be talking to, a larger general audience. Of the remaining 50% of the pie, it's divided up between a lot of corporate B2B messaging, right, and a lot of branding messaging, a significantly growing luxury audience, and then a hodgepodge of governmental or economic boards or tourism boards type play. It's really interesting because when you have five platforms and you're in 120 countries worldwide, and we own the pipes into all of the countries, right? So this is not a scenario where we're a US-based company that, syndicates out to a licensee abroad. Like, we literally almost syndicate it. We broadcast into almost every single country that we partner with, and we control those pipes. You start seeing just a tremendous diversity of who you're partnering with. And I think that if you think of us more through the lens of who do you go to satiate your business life, right? And you're not, one person at work and one person at home, but more of a holistic being, you start realizing that you can play validly in all of these fields.
Okay. never thought about satiating my business life before, but I'm going to start. I'm going to start to do that. All right, terrific. Now, talk about programmatic. How would you summarize your programmatic strategy?
So programmatic's a funny space for me because I would say 3 years ago when I came to Bloomberg, I don't know if I had a tremendous understanding of how vast it was. And over the time, you know, I definitely made a few mistakes in the beginning, a few mistakes in the middle. I think we've gotten a lot better in terms of how we are moving towards it. And we've been very successful while we've been making those mistakes. But I think that the way that we think about programmatic is that if something can ultimately be digitized, it will. Doesn't mean that their analog or terrestrial or linear counterpart dies. It just simply means that if a digital duplication or replication of an experience can exist, it will be digitized.
And then, once something is digital, it will be traded programmatically.
And then ultimately, if it's digitized, you said it, and it's perfect, it's more effective and efficient for a computer to trade it with a computer. And then when you think about that, it sounds scary to a sales organization, but it's really not. It's scary if you are a reactive seller. It's scary if you're in ad ops and you aren't passionate about what you do and don't think about yourself from the lens of an analyst or an optimizer where you see the value of yield management. But, it's ultimately every dollar that we have that is digitized will be bought and sold by a computer. And, you know, the common misperception is programmatic is cheap rates. That makes sense if you're moving a product such as, you know, a CPG product where ultimately it doesn't make a difference who the target is, whether it's a CEO or, you know, anyone. But if you're targeting a very specific niche audience, every time you need a data layer applied, the CPM adjusts because you're adjusting the supply and demand ratios of what your inventory is to mm-hmm. the overarching market. And so it's a natural progression.
Mm-hmm. For with your programmatic sales, do you do the open exchange thing, or are you more about private deals, PMPs, guaranteed but transacted programmatically using software?
We're not ruling anything out yet. You know, we are playing in the open market at times. We do PMPs, and we do automatic guarantees as well. For me, you know, what we noticed in the beginning was we did a test a little bit a few months ago, and we put a little bit of inventory out for a $1 CPM, and then we put a little bit of inventory out for a $100 CPM, same inventory but different days, mm-hmm. right? And then we alternated the days. We did over a two-week period. Mm. And we had the same advertisers bidding on us at $1 and at $100. Hmm. And it was eye-opening because it wasn't that we learned what to set our CPM with that test, but what we learned was that there are certain types of inventory that are more, you know, flexible than one would suspect. And what does it say if the same advertiser is bidding on us $1 versus $100?
Right. It's good information to have anyway.
Totally.
Helps with your forecasting, helps with your pricing.
Indeed.
Has that been the main value of programmatic for you? Is just a way to optimize for yield?
No. I would say that the main value is that for, I think, any publisher today or brand today, you want to remove as much friction as possible from what's required to transact and to partner with a client. And at the same time, you see increasingly that it's important that, you know, people reduce as much waste as possible. There's no scenario where you're going to have the ideal outcome of zero waste. It just doesn't exist. It's technically impossible. We could talk about that at mm-hmm. length for like episode like 12 of a podcast, but I think that what programmatic provides is an ease of transaction should that be the method in which somebody wants to partner with us. It also provides an opportunity for us to play in the yield management space more effectively, and it opens us up to thinking about sort of how do we price ourselves differently, not annually or monthly or weekly or even daily, but ultimately down to the millisecond. And I don't think we're there yet, but my dream is to be in a world where we actually don't have a static rate card, but rather we have a fully dynamic one.
That terrifies buyers, by the way, when the seller has so much insight into their bidding activity that they can raise the price floor if they see this buyer coming in and essentially kind of hijack the second price auction model and it just is a what turn it into effectively a first price model.
Well, here you have to remember that the flip side that a buyer would have is that they have a disproportionate understanding of how the marketplace is working from their perspective, mm-hmm. right? So ultimately, it's not that I will ever be able to move the price so out of whack to the equilibrium, but rather if I can more effectively set my price today at what is the fair market value of what my inventory is, I think that the thought philosophically terrifies buyers. I think that the reality
of— they're used to having a lot of leverage in the programmatic transaction.
Yeah.
And they bring the data. The publisher doesn't know what they would have paid. They only know what they managed to sell it for.
Sure. I mean, I had a very interesting conversation with somebody once where they said to me at the end of 2016, they said, what was I most excited about? And I said, oh, we had this program and we sold it for X for the whole year. And it was 3 months before the end of 2016. And the person looked at me and said, you do realize that you sold it for too little. And I thought about it for a second, and I didn't respond immediately, but I thought about that comment for a second, and I realized the person was 100% correct because the buyer had more information about the marketplace than I did, mm-hmm. and so I priced it incorrectly. Now, it doesn't mean I'm going to go back and not honor the pricing. I'm going to stick with that, but it does open your perspective up to we are in a moment where a lot is changing in the media industry. I think that the transparency is really important. I think it's key. But also people are beginning to realize on both the sales side and on the buying side the true value of what their inventory is. Mm. And in some cases, it's below what was being asked in the marketplace. And in some cases, it's way inflated, right? So mm-hmm. I think that that's a reality that people will have to come to too.
Okay, great. Great stuff. And do you mind my asking, what is your ad tech stack look
sure.
like? Like what are the tools in your belt?
So we do a lot with Google AdX, mm-hmm. who's been a wonderful partner. Mm-hmm. And we are bringing Index Exchange on board and OpenX on board. And very excited on that front. And we use Crux as a DMP.
Okay. Interesting. And since you mentioned the DMP, talk about your data asset. I mean, you see people who are researching financial vehicles mm-hmm. on your content pages. Are you – that's a data asset. Mm-hmm. That's, intent data there. What else is there in your sort of data arsenal?
Well, I would say what we're beginning to really understand, we just hired Michelle Lin. And she joined us from Dentsu Aegis, and she had overseen research and data analytics and insights for them. And she was there for, I think, 14, 15 years. Mm. And she, brilliant. And she has on her team, a really smart team of individuals, some that we brought internally over from Bloomberg LP, where, Bloomberg actually employs a tremendous amount of statisticians, tremendous amount of engineers. Mm-hmm. And so we were very fortunate to bring over, a few. And they've really looked into some of the sort of inner workings of how's our audience interacting with our content. Stuff that we learned was in some instances, if you go outside of the traditional path and you say you're a luxury advertiser, what do I invest with you if I don't want to just be on Bloomberg Pursuits? And what we noticed was very simple patterns that 1/3 of everyone who starts in Bloomberg Pursuits, not anywhere else in Bloomberg, but literally goes to Bloomberg Pursuits to begin with, We even go to another section of our site. And of the section of our site that they go to, it tends to be currency or emerging markets. And, you know, it might not make sense to have a luxury advertiser appear in currency or emerging markets from the onset, but that is where people are moving to. Mm-hmm. The flip side is that we were challenged by a really large partner to look at, how do we hit retail investors that come to our site? And we started to look at, you know, individuals who looked up the stock of the company numerous times over the course of a month, and their cookie said to us, hey, you know, this person looked up the stock, and then came to our site. And what we found was there was certain keywords that if were in the title, they were up to 98 times more likely to read that article. And when the company name itself was actually listed, it was 480 times more likely to read that article because it was so enamored with the individual. As a matter of fact, when certain categories were listed, they were 17 times more likely to read these categories. The flip side of it was the most interesting, which was they were far more likely to read it on the weekend than on the weekday. So think about that, right? Most of us are trained when we put together media plans to think about the value of the weekday inventory, and we diminish the weekend inventory. The weekend inventory is just as valuable, if not more valuable. It's not like the internet goes away on the weekend, which is, you know, something that I would love to figure out how to solve.
It'd be great if it did, wouldn't it?
Sometimes I wish it would.
We could like sit on the porch and read a book.
I would love that.
So what's changing with the buy side? Like, how is their ask changing over time? Are you detecting any shifts there?
I would say, you know, the asks are definitely changing, right? I think that there are more moments of winner takes all because I think that the buy side is looking at the value of larger ideas, more integrated packages, more integrated ideas, partners that can bring to the table, you know, a tremendous amount of solutions across whether it's platforms or, you know, countries, being able to tell those stories.
In other words, a big bank looking for a single media partner to do a major integrated buy across their portfolio, and they're going to give it to one or the other.
Yeah. Okay. And I would say, you know, like we see quite a few. I would say we have four or five that run exclusively with Bloomberg. But there's, I would say, a good amount of partners that run ultimately with fewer than five partners, right? And if you think about that, it's a very interesting transition in the marketplace from even a few years back, where I think that, you know, you would rarely see major blue chip companies sort of centralize their messaging across five disparate partners that, you know, complemented themselves nicely, but then really went deep within the vertical that they played within.
Did it surprise you to see Chase make an announcement essentially about reducing the number of sites they buy from 100,000 to 5,000 or whatever? I don't think that's what it was, but
no, it was, I think it was 400,000.
400,000, right? Okay.
To 5,000. No, it didn't surprise me.
Did it surprise you that they had been buying from so many?
No. You know, I think that it's a wonderful move. We're at a very interesting inflection point right now. I was surprised. I was in London when the Havas position took place on YouTube, and it was a very small story at first. It was just like a handful of advertisers, and then it spread to the larger agency. And you know, we're beginning to see in the marketplace a large number of clients and advertisers really consider the contextual relevance of what their message is aligned against. And I think that's really important. Like, for a very long time, when things were digitized, it was so easy to think about scale and audience, but not think about who was actually on the receiving end of that. And I think that what the YouTube and Google sort of scenario presents is not the end of YouTube and Google. They're going to fix it. They'll figure out how to target it properly. They'll, you know, they're beyond brilliant in that area. It represents a moment where the industry is starting to say to itself, contextual relevance matters, right? And by the way, Chase's position doesn't say that programmatic is wrong either. But what it does signal is that the way in which technologies target and implement ads is off. It's not quite there yet. And everyone wants to think it's perfect and perfected. But anyone who is in the trenches for a little bit and kicks the tires on it a little bit realizes, you know, the expectation far exceeds what the true delivery is today. And I think that when you start realizing that programmatic and contextual relevance is they're not mistakes, and they're full on trends, the direction where the industry is going in, but that they're sort of going down a – like their flaws are being exposed a little bit, you start realizing like, well, okay, so what is the bigger story that's also being told there, and that's a fake news story? And you start realizing, huh, like, again, that's a contextual story, which is it's really important that partners align themselves against good content, that they could target it properly, and that they know that it's, you know, providing utility to a smart audience.
Yeah. Now, the buyers have they certainly have been loud on these two issues of brand safety mm-hmm. and, to a lesser extent, fake news. Mm-hmm. To what extent do you think they're walking the walk versus just talking the talk?
Well, first, they should be loud about it. Like, there should yeah. be no scenario where
– But there are people who think that it's just part of a negotiation they're having with the big platform companies, and they're just – you know, it's kind of like they pretend like they're going to pick up their toys and go home. And then everybody scrambles to appease them. Mm-hmm. That's one interpretation. The other one is – oh, they're really going to change their spending behavior because these things matter to them fundamentally. And it's not really about just getting a lower rate or getting certain concessions, you know, mm-hmm. on things like viewability. Or do you think they're serious? Do you think you're going to see 100 companies like Chase really dramatically change their behavior?
So,
and then the follow-up question is, do brands really care about fake news versus real news?
So, okay. So I think both very fair questions. I mean, I hope that everyone is very serious about this. I think it's really important. And I think that what you're beginning to see is brands actually voting with their dollars in areas where they don't feel comfortable with the contextual relevance or the alignment. And you see it, you know. I read an article over the weekend about, you know, O'Reilly having only 7 advertisers on, you know, the show, and that everyone from Mercedes and Audi and everyone else pulled. And you see what Havas did in the UK, and you see that Google, you know, begins to adjust its algorithms, and you see some of the challenges that, you know, Facebook faces, you know, some rightfully so, some you know, incorrectly purported, but, you know, they'll adjust and they'll fix and tweak. But, and you see what happened with Breitbart, you know, following the election and, you know, the programmatic space and advertisers really being serious in that area. And so as of this moment, everything leads me to believe that people are serious about this and that this is a moment where things are going to get cleaned up a little bit. And I hope that it continues on. Now, as it relates to fake news, you know, do advertisers really care or not? I think that the bigger question is do advertisers really care whether or not their ad is seen next to something that provides true utility to their to the consumer or not? I personally don't think that any advertiser goes out and says, I want to align with fake news. And I don't think that there's a single consumer on the world that says, you know what I really am in the mood for today? Like the news is so awesome or so depressing, but I would rather have fake news, right? Like I don't think that anyone exists that starts their day off with, I need fake news with my coffee. And so, you know, what fake news does is it wins one or two times, right? But it doesn't win. It's not a long-term strategy, right? So it's literally like something that wins one or two times until somebody realizes that they've been deceived. And I think that that act of deception is so infuriating to both the consumer and to the advertiser that I do think that there will be a larger movement over time that tries to purge it down a little bit more.
Let's hope so.
Is that a fair answer?
No, that's a great answer. Thank you. I want to spend a few minutes before we wrap on talking about platforms. It's been a real existential question for publishers, how they respond to the rise of big walled gardens, you know, and distributing content and monetizing in those environments. Facebook's the big one that everybody talks about. There's also, you know, Google, Snapchat, Twitter, you know, and I'm sure others. Let's talk about the Bloomberg walled sort of platform distribution strategy. How would you characterize it?
I would say that in certain areas we are somewhat aggressive. Like I would say in Twitter, where we don't really require user authentication on our video feeds. You know, we streamed the presidential debates and had tremendous response on that. 3.2 million people on one of the debates. 2.4 million people watched live over Twitter. Mm-hmm. Our feed, you know, for one of the debates. We broadcast every day on Twitter three shows that, you know, in aggregate, you know, get about 1 million views a day, which is great, you know. I would say that on some of the other platforms, we've been more cautious, and I'll explain why in a second. But I would say that in areas like Apple News, you know, we were a first adopter in that, and we thought that there was value in experimenting there and playing there. But I do think that there is value in watching how the marketplace develops more than being the first person that jumps at some of them sometimes.
It does seem like it's sort of constantly in flux.
And I think that one of the reasons is it goes back to your first question to me about what's it like to be a media company within a larger LP that is not a media entity. And one of the things that provides us is protection in the sense of we don't have to make short-term decisions. We don't have to make irrational decisions or rational decisions or what's perceived as rational decisions at the moment. You know, when I was in my previous job at Wired, my partner, Howard Mittman, and I were very vocal about pulling the Wired brand off of Flipboard in the beginning. And we also worked with The New Yorker and convinced them to pull off of Flipboard in the beginning too. And when we did it, Wired was one of the largest, you know, audiences that Flipboard had. And one of the reasons was we produce a lot of content and we have a great relationship with our consumer on our owned site. We don't know what the rules are going to be if all of a sudden a platform comes in and disintegrates or the relationship between us and our reader, right? And simply just becomes the distribution model, and then we become a commodity in the platform's eyes. And then all of a sudden, the platform gains enough steam that they could turn around and they could say, "Hey, we control X percent of your total traffic, right? And if you don't pay us X," which is a very real thing. I mean, look what Snapchat did to the original publishers of the Discover feature, where they said, we're no longer going to let you make money, but rather we're going to pay you a licensing fee, or we're going to pay you a fee, and then we're going to keep the difference.
Sure.
You know, I think that there's value in sometimes just sitting back and not necessarily being a first, but being a fast follower in the areas where it makes sense.
You don't have to be all in.
No. And in Twitter case, I will say this, is Twitter gets a bad rap at times. But, you know, A, they've been amazing partners to work with. B, Twitter's a very effective news distribution source. Mm-hmm. And, you know, for what it's worth, they are able to disseminate information and do it very quickly. And they're a platform that aligns really nicely against our brand.
Mm-hmm. And it was interesting to hear the Flipboard example, just because it's just a very early example of what's being hotly debated today. It just shows these issues aren't new.
Yeah.
But with Facebook Instant Articles in particular, there's been a push to give us your content. We'll monetize that for you using a variety of methods and then cut you a check. Maybe we'll even help you get sign up subscriptions or things like that. Do you trust Facebook to be that kind of partner on the money side?
I don't. It's not that I trust them or I don't trust them. I don't need them today, right? And you know, I think it's one of those things where until I fully understand the full spectrum of what happens when you turn over a brand, I'm not ready to say, sure, let's do that. Now, the flip side is that, again, back to the, you know, being part of a larger non-media entity, I'm resourced differently than some publishers who might require necessarily quick influxes of cash or a check being written for certain things that I just don't think is necessarily the healthiest long-term option to play.
All right, terrific. Well, we're going to leave it there. Keith Grossman, thank you so much for coming in. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
And to the listener, thanks for tuning in to another episode of AdExchanger Talks. Please leave us a review and subscribe if you haven't already. Thank you.
Recorded at the studios of Bigfoot Music and Sound in New York City.